Hello, mainstreamers and cinephiles and everybody in between. I'm Bryant.
And I'm Caitlin.
And Operation Silver Screen is a go. Hello, welcome to Operation Silver Screen. This cinema-related operation has been created to clear our desks from stacks of open cases. What are these cases? Well, even being the film lovers that we are, Caitlin and I have a huge backlog of must-see films that we still need to experience. So each week, we'll tackle a film that either one of us or both of us have not seen. We will then provide a debrief of our week's mission, giving our outlook on the film's popularity and significance, as well as providing our opinion on whether or not it's worth seeing and other fun insight. Caitlin, what was our assignment this week?
So this week we caught a train ride and was hoping for a meet cute as we tackled the must-see romantic comedy from Frank Capra, It Happened One Night, which was released in 1934. And this week we do have a special guest today, Mike, who is the co-host of the Old Switcheroo podcast, and which is a retro gaming podcast, and he also has an interest in film. So why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Yeah, so one of the things I do is host the Old Switcheroo. Our tagline is Gaming Retro with Mike and JMO. JMO is a friend of mine that I've known since we were like five. And so the thing that we are doing is we're exploring the Nintendo Switch Online retro catalog. That if you have a subscription to Nintendo Switch Online and a Switch, you get access to a little over 250 games that they have made available from the NES, SNES, Game Boy, Game Boy Advance, Nintendo 64, and the Sega Genesis for some reason that is weird, but I appreciate. And so every episode we go through a couple of those and sort of see how those hold up, both the prominent games and the not so prominent games.
Yeah, I actually just learned about that feature recently and I've been paying for the online. So I'm like, oh, I didn't know I could have been doing this whole time.
Yeah, we've kind of realized that I think we are the best advertisement for that service. And it's like they should be paying us because they do not make it clear that that's a thing that you can do. And there's a ton of stuff on there that, because I'm doing this and mentioning to people, have people like, oh, I did not realize that I could have spent the last few months playing all of Zelda on here. Why was I not doing that kind of situations?
Now, what about your film background, your background with movies?
Yeah, so I think this comes from, I'm from LA. And so that is very much a film town.
I've heard.
And so even though... Nothing that I do career-wise has anything to do with movies or school-wise, but a lot of this probably actually started 2005. I camped out for Star Wars in Hollywood for like a month with a large group of people, and that kind of got me into out at theaters more and seeing a lot of film, and then that has particularly started picking back up 2019, and then 2020 when I couldn't go anywhere, really sort of doubled down on that. So I think, like, I've been using Letterboxd off and on for about a decade now. And of that, I think I've got a little... I've got almost 3,400 feature films logged on there.
Wow.
Of which, like, a third are 1930s, 1940s.
So you like old film, then?
So I do. I like old film. Old film also has the advantage that a lot of that is available for streaming relatively cheaply.
Yeah.
So that also sort of helps. Huge watcher of TCM.
Me too. I love TCM. That's all I use Max for, really.
Yeah, no, that's... I am very appreciative for the TCM standalone sort of service. And so I'm kind of split between old films that... Or at least Golden Age Hollywood. I'm not going to say classic films, because a lot of the things that I watch from that I don't think are classic. They're just old. And then also a lot of more... genre-y films, especially sci-fi, horror, general weirdness that's more recent. So I'm kind of split into fairly different camps that are most of what I watch. Used to see a lot more in theater stuff. So I think 2010, I saw over 100 films in theater, which really is only a thing you can do in LA because you need to have over 100 films in show.
Yeah, that's huge.
So it's a lot of $2 theaters and a lot of art house, independent film kind of stuff. So that is a huge amount of my consumption.
Yeah. Nice. Now, I do have two questions for you as well, just to kind of fill out your case file a little bit, because we are cinema detectives here. And the first question is, what's your favorite movie that you think is a popular choice that you think a lot of people have seen? And then what's your favorite movie that you think is more of a hidden gem, something that you don't think a lot of people have seen and you kind of want to recommend to them?
Could I do two and two?
Yeah, sure. Go for it.
This is also my Letterboxd top four. The two that I think are fairly well known, both are older films, are 12 Angry Men is probably my top film, period.
Okay.
It's impressive just how much that does with a single room to work with.
Mm-hmm.
Because almost all of it takes place in a single room of a jury. And then Casablanca is also up there, which is just a film that I really appreciate.
It's kind of funny you say that those are your popular choices. I've seen 12 Angry Men, but Brian hasn't. And then, but I don't think either of us have seen Casablanca, actually.
I've seen Casablanca.
Oh, but I haven't seen Casablanca and Brian has. That's why we have this podcast.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, I put those two because when I get to the next two, then it will be clear why okay. those two were the popular category. The other two I would go with would be, one is Quiet On, which is a 1960s sort of, I think it's often called a horror, but it's more of like a dark fantasy anthology film from Japan.
Okay.
That I think is one of the most beautiful films I've ever seen.
Hmm. Yeah, definitely haven't seen that one.
Which I first discovered on TCM. And actually, it was the last film I saw before COVID lockdown saw in theater. And so I think that is an absolutely amazing movie. I think it is in the Criterion Collection okay. at this point.
You say Quiet On?
Yeah, with a K. So it's Kwaiden.
Okay, I was close.
Were you?
And I'm pretty sure I'm not pronouncing it proper either. And then the other one is Voyage of the Rock Aliens, which is a 1984 sci-fi comedy musical.
Okay, that sounds fun.
Yeah, that has really good music. It's a film that I believe is a cult classic that didn't get to have the cult. And so I have been trying to start that ever since I found this movie.
Gotcha, okay.
Yeah, so that one is significantly more obscure. Has gotten a Blu-ray release within the last couple years.
Oh, that's nice. That is nice.
Yeah. Has Jermaine Jackson on the opening song.
Hmm. You'll have to definitely put this on my watch list.
Yeah. The last I checked, it was still on Tubi, which is how I discovered it the first time. And I went into it knowing nothing and absolutely loved it. And then have been slowly subjecting people to it whenever I can corner them with that DVD or with that Blu-ray, rather.
Tubi is so nice. Like, for a free service, like, it has some drawbacks, of course, but it offers so many movies. So, you say you like old films. Now, for this film, for It Happened One Night, is this one that you've seen before this podcast?
Yeah, so I've seen it a couple times.
Okay.
Initially, about a decade ago, I had gone through to make it a point to see all the Best Picture winners, and I was trying to complete the AFI Top 100.
Okay.
So, which I think the fact that it's on both of those will come up a bit more in detail later, I suspect. And so I had sought it out for that when I was really first. That was sort of how I started exploring film, and then I ended up with areas that I kept returning to more and more.
Mm-hmm. And Brian, you haven't seen this film at all till this week, right?
I have not.
Yeah, this is my first time watching it as well. This is our second Frank Capra film that we've covered on the podcast. We did It's a Wonderful Life this past Christmas. This is, I think, my fourth film overall from him. I've also seen Arsenic and Old Lace and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. So this is a little bit different than those films. And it's a film that we wanted to cover because it did just have its 90th anniversary in February. But we did have some scheduling issues, so we did push it back to this month. And Brian, what have you been able to find as far as the critical reception to this film?
This has a 8.1 on IMDb, making it the number 247 out of their top 250. This has a 98% on Rotten Tomatoes for critics with a 93% audience rating, so pretty much in agreement. This won 5 Oscars, Best Picture, Best Actor in a Lead Role, Best Actress in a Lead Role, Best Director, and Best Writing Adaption. We'll talk about the significance of those 5 Oscars later. This was also in the Criterion Collection, or is in the Criterion Collection, and this is also in the 1001 Movies to Watch Before You Die.
Yeah, and when this film was originally released, it didn't have a huge ad campaign, and it was released to more limited theaters. So most of the reviews were positive. There were a couple of critics who called it nonsense, and they did criticize the plot. But then a little bit later on, it had a second theater run, and it got to screen in more smaller towns where it really found its audience and became more of a box office hit. A 2021 article by Slash Film states that, adjusted for inflation, It Happened One Night made over $342 million. It was also selected for preservation in the National Film Registry by the Library of Congress, which we talk about a lot for these films. Mike, was there anything you were able to find for its reception or anything significant that you noticed?
Well, one thing I'd add that you sort of mentioned with the small initial release, and this kind of ties into it, is that this was not coming out of one of the major studios. This was what was at the time a considered a Poverty Row studio. Even though Columbia now is a fairly big name, at the time it wasn't. And so it's not too surprising that it had a relatively small release, especially given that a lot of the people that were involved were not necessarily thrilled to be doing that. Clark Gable was in this movie sort of as a punishment, that MGM had sent him over to Columbia basically as a penalty. And Claudette Colbert so didn't think it was a good movie that she wasn't at the Oscars. So there's kind of, it's not surprising that it had this slow start, but it just comes out so good that it built up because audiences loved it. Even though, even within the people working on this movie, it wasn't that popular at the time.
Yeah. And Columbia Pictures, when this came out, I think it was only like 10 years old. I think this is the 100th year anniversary for it this year.
Yeah, they're owned by Sony currently.
Okay, that I didn't realize.
Yeah, they were bought from the Coca-Cola company. Coca-Cola used to own them. Sony bought them for, I just read, $3.4 billion.
Okay. Now, before we get too much into this film, I do want to mention that the first part of our podcast is going to be spoiler-free. We're going to talk about our overall thoughts on the film without going into spoilers until we get into our classified portion of the podcast, and that's when we're going to talk about spoilers on the story. But we'll give you a warning when we get to that part. And just to give you a little bit of a summary about this film so you kind of know what's going on, It Happened One Night starts with the heiress Ellie Andrews on a yacht as her father ships her away from her new husband, King Wesley, whom her father proclaims is a gold digger and plans to annul the marriage. Ellie is not happy with this, so she jumps ship, quite literally, and heads out on a bus to reunite with her lover. There she meets Peter Warren, a newspaper man looking for a break. As the headlines pull in about the missing heiress, Peter agrees to help Ellie on her adventure in exchange for a story, and thus begins their road trip together. Ellie is played by Claudette Colbert, and Peter is played by Clark Gable.
Yes, this is also based on a short story called The Night Bus. And just to clarify, this does not take place in the medieval times. Because like that beginning of your description, I was like, wait a minute, an heiress? A king? And then you're like, road trip? I'm like, what the heck? What? Yeah, no.
I think they were... I don't think they called them heiresses in medieval times, though.
And I think also it's
did they not?
That I think this is entirely king being used as a first name, which very much feels like a 1930s thing. Oh, I'm also reminded there's a director, King Vidor, around the same era, where it was just as a first name.
Well, I have been bamboozled. I thought he was a king.
actual king.
Yeah, I think it is just... That is the name that he has.
Okay. Well, some of this movie lost impact in certain scenes for me.
Yeah, I think when I first started watching, I thought that it was like a fake king. Like, oh, I'm a king. You should marry me. Like a scam. But no, I think you're right. It is his first name.
Well, I thought it was just one of those kingdoms that weren't dissolved.
No, I think it's, I imagine at the same thing, like 80 years from now, if people talk about the musician Prince, people will be very confused that he was not actually born of a royal family. Like, at some point, people lose that it is just a that it was just a name. In his case, a name he lived up to, but a name.
Yeah.
Next, you're going to tell me the queens weren't royalty.
At least most of those. Outrageous.
So, Mike, I want to hear a little bit about your opinion of this film. And I want to hear about it from also... What was your opinion when you first watched this, and did it change watching it now?
I think from the first time I've watched it to now, so this is at least the third time I've watched it, I think a lot of what surprised me at first really is that there's a lot of films that are considered classics that I don't necessarily agree with. And I think this was one of the first ones that I watched, I'm like, I 100% understand why this is considered a classic film. That I do, I like comedy, and this is really sort of one of the first screwball comedies. I think it's sometimes referred to as the first. There's a couple, like The Year Before, that would fit that title as well. I know that you guys have talked about screwball comedies recently-ish with His Girl Friday as well.
Yeah, we did. And just to kind of redefine what that is, I grabbed a definition from the website New Film School that I'll also link on our social media. But according to them, screwball comedies are a genre of comedy that emerged in the 1930s and became popular in the 1930s and 1940s. So this one came out in 1934. They are characterized by their fast-paced witty dialogue, farcical situations, and romantic storylines that often involve a battle of the sexes. So there's a lot of gender dynamics usually in play at screwball comedies. And personally, I love screwball comedies. It's probably one of my favorite genres when I'm looking at older film.
Yeah, and I think one of the other dynamics that shows up in a lot of them that that definition doesn't mention is there's usually also a class element to them. Or at least there's frequently a class element when you're dealing with a screwball comedy. So you have this idea of someone that is of much higher status, or generally it is someone who was much wealthier and someone who was not. And so some of the other ones that kind of show up are movies like My Man Godfrey and You Can't Take It With You and Sullivan's Travels that all have this financial element to it as well, where you are dealing with someone who's wealthy and someone who is not. And usually it is making at least some level of criticism about that kind of wealth, which is not surprising to see make it into film in the mid to late 1930s, because this is right after the Great Depression, or really still in the Great Depression to some extent. And so it's not surprising to see that as another element in there, which His Girl Friday doesn't have that class element, but this certainly relies on it.
Yeah. And as a story, what did you think about this one?
One of the interesting things about that, so I like the story. One of the things that is odd in this is the ending becomes very familiar if you have seen another much later movie that I was introduced to first and didn't know that it basically uses the last 20 minutes of this movie. And so I'll save the details of that for the classified session, because I believe one of you has seen it. And I don't think the other one has for the movie that I'm talking about. So I'll save it till that point. So certainly the first time I watched it, it was a very weird moment because I started to realize that I knew what was going to happen. Specifically, which sort of clouded me a bit from the rest of this. So certainly coming back to it and where that's no longer a surprise, I do really enjoy this because so much of this is, so much of that story is a lot of, I think, well-driven character, because it is watching two characters make their situations somewhat worse because neither of them are being fully open with one another. In a way that feels very human. It's not, there's a lot of movies that kind of fall on trope where it's like, well, yeah, you could have just said that, but you, instead you kept saying it's not what it seems 10 times. It's like, you could have clarified this. Here it feels very natural for why all those miscommunications happen the way they do to me. And so it still feels very, very believable in that sense for what would reflect still some elements of 1930s society, but it feels very genuine to me.
Yeah. Brian, this being your first time watching, what was your opinion on this?
I think I'm there with you, Caitlin, with screwball comedies. I'm going to have to check out a lot more. Ones that, you know, we don't have to do for the show and recommend some for the show. Because, I just really enjoy this back and forth banter, the wittiness of it. Like I said, His Girl Friday has one of my favorite jokes of all time written into it. I get a lot of laughs from this, more than I'm expecting from this time period. The story, I mean, we've seen the story quite a few times, so I know where it was going, though it's still, you know, with its humor and then also, again, its time period, it was going into at least different settings and locations and situations that were a bit different from the more modern tales of that are similar. Yeah, I really enjoy this. I enjoy the two characters. I think there's some, maybe just a little bit of outdated masculinity in this, a little like kind of borderline misogyny, but nothing that made me like dislike the character or anything like that. You know, I can see him in a couple years, you know, reshaping definitely. So yeah, the Claudette, her character, you know, she has some great lines as well. And she's, you know, she really has her own personality, her own sense of humor, her own comebacks that are, you know, it's great to have two strong characters there. It's not like just one of them is for comedy and the other is a straight person. So I enjoy this quite a bit.
Yeah, and I think that's really almost a necessary thing with the screwball comedies is the female characters are strong, involved characters, even in something like this, where much of this is pointing out how out of touch she is, that she's so used to being surrounded by wealth that she really doesn't understand how to survive without it. Even without that, she's still very strong-minded. And a lot of those screwball comedies have those very strong female characters, because it wouldn't work without it. It wouldn't have that dynamic of A, that these people cannot stand each other at some point is usually a factor of that, and B, it really is that you are watching this battle, and for that to work and be interesting, you actually need them to both be given sufficient strength that's a battle and not just watching one person just totally dominate the other.
Yeah. And I mean, I also really like this film, and the characters for me, like, they were a little bit difficult for me to get in at the very beginning, but it's kind of interesting because their characters really do open up as the film develops, and I really liked them. Ellie's character in particular, like, she was like so cute when she was opening up. I thought her character was adorable because she starts off very like hard as nails, very argumentative, and then when you kind of see this relationship start to kind of bloom, like, her whole personality changes. And Clark Gable, his character, like you said, there are times that it does borderline a little bit misogynistic thinking, but I don't think it didn't affect my enjoyment, because I can also see that a lot of it's a front for feelings that he's trying to conceal. So it's a really good dynamic between the two of them. And it's a good road movie as well. It has a lot of same tropes that you see in road trip movies, and they kind of go kind of about place to place as they're traveling. So that was interesting as well, and added an interesting progression to the story. So yeah, I really liked this film.
I mean, really shouldn't surprise us. There's another movie this really reminded me of that we both loved, which was DDLJ.
Yes. Yep. Mm-hmm. Maybe I had that under influence.
And that's not me trying to be cryptic. If you want to know what that stands for, you got to Google it or go back to our episode for the one time that I try to pronounce it. Oh, you're going to go for it, Caitlin?
I think I'm going to go for it. Hold on. Let me look it up, because I have to see it. Because I'm blanking on what the second D stands for.
Which has become one of our most popular episodes, too. If you haven't seen that episode, definitely.
It's Diwale Duhania Le Jayenhe. That's an Indian rom-com that we seen and stars SRK and Kajol, two very big romantic comedy actors in India. But yeah, I think that really any romantic comedy is going to draw from this film. And it has tropes. It's a very tropey movie. If we're looking at it from like the current way that we view a lot of media, we'd say, oh, these have a lot of romantic tropes in there. It has fake relationship, forced proximity, oh, they're stuck in a hotel room together, enemies to lovers, like all these kind of buzzwords, you know, that you could say about this movie. But it's significant because it really did pioneer that. Not to go too much into significance, but it really added to my enjoyment of the film, kind of seeing these interactions. And it does it in a way that still felt fresh. I think that we see a lot of films that certain tropes or ideas started from, and they don't feel like they are quite there or as good as modern movies that do similar things. But this one feels like it stood up on its own, and I really enjoyed the tension that it brought, and it worked for me.
Yeah, I think this established tropes that very quickly other movies were trying to do. So, like I mentioned, MGM lended Clark Gable out for this, and then it became a giant success, and that was with an actor they had under contract. And so actually, in 1936, MGM released a movie with Clark Gable, which, stop me if you've heard this before, Clark Gable is a newspaper reporter, and he is traveling with a recently married socialite that he then ends up sort of developing this falling in love with. And so that was 2 years later, and MGM realized that they have Clark Gable under contract, It Happened One Night was a great success. Why don't they just make another movie like that? And so Love on the Run from 1936 feels incredibly similar to this. I still think it's good, but it's because they are effectively trying to imitate a very good movie.
Yeah. And it also helps that the romantic chemistry, I think, was there between the characters. Romantic chemistry is there, and I can definitely applaud the actors for it, but I can also applaud the directing as well. It was interesting looking up stuff for this movie and finding out it actually came out like 4 months before the Hays Code. Because the thing of the Hays Code is that so many directors, we saw this, or I think I mentioned this with George Stevens in one of his films, The More the Merrier, how they kind of got to get a little bit creative with how they build up that sexual tension. And so I think that there's a way in this film that it did it very well, and it kind of tried to avoid controversy when they have them in the same room together by putting a sheet between the beds. And it's called the Wall of Jericho, they call it. And it kind of plays around with that, and it kind of comes like a joke in the film. And I thought that that was an interesting way to build the tension. And the way it shot was very interesting. And like I said, it really reminds me of George Stevens' films The More the Merrier, where it's kind of shot similar because you think that they're in one room, but there's actually a wall between them. So, I mean, I'm not trying to say that it was influenced by that, but it could have been. But definitely the way that these directors had to navigate around sex and tension was just, it was interesting. And I think it made for interesting dynamics and really good chemistry. But I think that, honestly, some romantic comedies kind of lack nowadays.
Yeah, I think actually, although IMDb says, and so I take that with some grain of salt, that part of that was also due to Claudette Colbert's restrictions on not wanting to be too revealed in some of the scenes, despite some of the other movies she had just recently made. And so that request came out of that. And it is, in either case, it's impressive because that is not intrinsic to the story, but it becomes such a key part of the story. Mm-hmm. And I think such a through line in there that it's really interesting that it wasn't a starting point. It's something that came in later and just fits in so well that it's hard to imagine the movie without it, to me.
Yeah, definitely.
You mentioned the beginning of this and kind of the way they set up these characters, Caitlin. And that's one thing that I really like, too, because they do kind of make them unlikable people in society. Like, not only can I see you two not getting along, I can just see most people not wanting to deal with you. So it was interesting. And they don't wait till the end to develop them into, you know, to rational, likable people. And I like that.
Yeah. Yeah, it leads for good character development. Now, there are some drawbacks to the film for me. I think that a lot of my problem, I mentioned this before on A Place in the Sun, but sometimes when you look at old Hollywood movies, they do kind of feel a little bit stagey, which is, you expect it also because of the limitations of camera movement at this time. Like, we didn't have as portable cameras at that time. So it's hard to not kind of get that feel, but I think that this film had enough differences in its scenes and locations that it felt I was okay with it. I didn't notice it too much.
Well, this also had tracking shots in it. And that kind of, yeah, it still feels a little bit stagey. Kind of feels like a longer stage at some points with the tracking shot. But yeah, it didn't really bother me too much. But I mean, I kind of, yeah, like you said, they had limitations during that time. Limitations and pre-notions about what the audience wanted to see. So, you know, anytime I go in a movie, I'm like, all right, don't think about this.
Yeah. There's also a couple pacing issues here and there for me, mostly towards the end, which I will say some of that for spoilers when we talk about that. But overall, like I said, I did enjoy this film. I don't know if you guys had any negatives that you came with this film.
I think the closest I have is, I think Claudel Colbert's character takes time for me to sort of adjust to, because I think there is something somewhat abrasive about her character because of sort of that wealth and the way it insulates her kind of thing that I've found with a lot of films. I think this one gets around it because it sort of adds additional layers to her. There's a lot of films that I watch that kind of present those kind of characters and never really address the that's a flaw kind of thing of wealthy characters with wealthy problems kind of things, where I'm like, I can only care about this so much. And so I think to the point that it's probably actually taken me a couple viewings of this to stop being as immediately put off by that.
Okay. That makes sense. I mean, that's definitely the character.
Yeah, it's just one of those things that every so often it's a character type that I come across enough that it's taken, and it may also just be I watched also enough other movies from that era that mm-hmm. kind of are willing to sort of take a wealthy character down a peg, because then you hit a stretch where film stops doing that. And that is a long stretch that I would say goes to very recently, mm-hmm. where the character being wealthy is just strictly a plus, and doesn't deal as well with how out of touch that is and how unrealistic that is.
Yeah, I can definitely see that.
Making a character that I can connect to.
Meanwhile, Caitlin's watching us in silk sheets and being fed grapes. Like, girl, I hear you. I hear your issues.
No, I am not. I'm not like that. Or wealthy, for that matter. One other thing I didn't like that I don't think the characters liked either was all the random singing. They did the whole bus was singing. The whole bus was singing. And I think they're okay with that. But for me, that went on a little bit too long. But then there was also the character who was actually annoying them that kept singing later on in the film.
So you have, honestly, the part in the bus, I kind of appreciate it because I have, there's not too much travel people do nowadays that really is this, I'm going to be stuck with these people for a long time.
Yeah.
And I have done cross-country on Amtrak, which is slightly more spacious than a bus, but not much more. And I actually, one of the things I remember about that was one of the nights going into the observing car. And there was three people who did not know each other that all had guitars that were playing music together because there was nothing else to do because we were somewhere in the middle of Kansas on a train about 15 years ago. And so people were not just relying on electronics entirely. It was like, we got to do something. And so there's actually there's an element of that that for me was actually weirdly reminiscent of that it does feel like I'm not at all surprised to see something like that go on in this. And then I actually the other time that it comes up is a brief part of this that has Alan Hale, who I think at this point is mostly known, if at all, because his son is Alan Hale, or was Alan Hale Jr., who was the skipper on Gilligan's Island.
Okay.
Who I think had opera training, and so I'm always pleased when I see him in a movie. So having him show up, even with the unnecessary singing, there's something about the way that he shows up in movies with the sort of personality he usually has, this same sort of very jovial kind of character.
Okay.
So it kind of shows up with the thing, but for me it is, there's a little bit of familiarity there that I think I enjoyed it as a bit of him in this movie.
Yeah, I don't know that I've seen anything else of him.
Can't say that
I'm hard pressed to name a specific large role he's had, but he's off. I think him is a lot more in supporting roles to some extent.
Yeah,
I would say there was a couple other influences this had that I was going to mention.
If you don't have anything to say, do you guys have anything else to talk about for your general opinion? But let's go ahead and go on into influences then. You want to start us off?
Yeah. So I think one of the other things I think may be a reason that some of this resonated with me somewhat well is, I think this isn't 100% confirmed, but is viewed as likely, that Clark Gable's character may have played a fairly large role in animator Fritz Freleng and the development of Bugs Bunny as a character.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a couple things if you hear the name Bugs mentioned in this and you hear Clark Gable refer to someone as Doc, but I think the big one that gets pointed to is one of the more memorable scenes where he's doing a lot of quick talking while eating carrots. Yep. And there's a lot in his character really that does feel similar to Bugs Bunny, just in general tone of this sort of quick talking, working a situation to his favor kind of things. Your introduction scene to him is him talking on the phone, and when the person he's talking to hangs up, he keeps the conversation going to make it seem like now he's winning the argument on the phone. And that is 100% a scene that I can imagine Bugs Bunny doing. And so for having watched enough Looney Tunes as a kid, I do kind of wonder if part of why I find his character quick to adjust to is that it simply influenced a character that I was already so used to.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. That animator, I think they also said that in one of his unpublished memoirs, he said that It Happened When I was one of his favorite movies as well. I think that also helps with the connection.
Yeah, so Clark Gable was one of three influences for Bugs Bunny. And I'm the same way. Once I saw him eating that carrot, it's like, wait, hold up. Bugs, why don't you get in this movie? And real quick, I don't know if you guys also want to answer, but Bugs Bunny is my favorite Looney Tune. It always has been. I don't know about you guys.
I think I liked Tweety Bird a lot.
I was about to guess Tweety Bird for you.
Yeah. But I do really like Bugs Bunny. He's probably like or Daffy. I don't know.
Yeah. It would explain a lot of my humor now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard to pick, but definitely in terms of like a Bugs Bunny Daffy dynamic at its best is mm-hmm. some of the best stuff Looney Tunes did, I think.
Yeah. Definitely.
And a lot of that actually is the same type of very quick-talking, fast-paced thing of that shows up in other things of this era and shows up in, like, screwball comedies and stuff. That same kind of pacing.
Yeah. What else were you able to find for influence?
Yeah, I mentioned this also had... There is a weird thing that I didn't realize was even a thing until maybe 2 years ago, that Hollywood used to revisit movies that were not musicals and would make them musicals. Mm. And that is a thing that I didn't realize happened until I kept watching movies and started hitting things where I'm like, this feels very familiar. And so this actually is one of the rare cases. I have not seen either of its musical remakes, but this was remade in 1945 as Eve Knew Her Apples. And then again in 1956 as You Can't Run Away From It.
Yeah, that one interests me because the You Can't Run Away From It has Jack Lemmon playing the Clark Gable role, which they're two very, very different actors. So I would be curious to see how that plays out.
Yeah, that is an odd casting.
Yeah.
I may have to seek that out faster now.
Yeah, that's what I was like. I was like, I have to look at that one. Yeah,
it is odd to see how they did that and kind of compare those, because they did it for a large number of them. Actually, there is a Letterboxd list someone put together of like Golden Age Hollywood films and the musicals that were made off of them, and usually it was within about a decade.
Yeah,
so I'm not surprised that this got two.
There's also a lot of remakes in India as well in varying languages. I won't sit here and list them all, but yeah, a lot of different remakes, and there's like also another unofficial remake called The Sure Thing that had John Cusack in it. But I think they said that it wasn't ever officially meant to be a remake, but I guess it's very similar.
Oh, yeah. And then this does have, I think, arguably one of the most parodied scenes in movie history, which is the hitchhiking scene where Clark Gable is attempting to hitchhike and is not succeeding. After having talked a very big game about knowing what he's doing, and then Claudette Colbert is like, all right, fine, I'll stop him. I won't need to use my thumb, walks over to the side of the road, pulls up her dress, and the first car slams on the brakes. Mm-hmm. And that has been reused a whole lot.
Yeah, and I was wondering how far that scene was going to go, because I feel like I saw it somewhere else. And yeah, it was very well directed. It was hilarious to me how quickly that dude stopped that car.
It was very quick.
I think IMDb says Claudette Colbert was refusing to do that, so they were using a body double for the leg, and then she's like, fine, I'll do it because that's not my leg. And she took offense to the leg that they had.
Yeah, I also saw that. Brian, what about you? What have you found for influence for this film?
So we talked about how this has influenced movies, you know, ever since. You have dynamics such as the poor boy, rich girl, or, you know, the working class male and the spoiled woman. The portrayal of couples with that beginning friction of hating each other, and then, you know, they start to fall in love.
Every Hallmark movie ever.
yeah, exactly. Some good, a lot bad, but some great. So you mentioned that this did kick off, this has been seen as screwball comedies first, the pioneer of it. So it was preceded by a movie called The Front Page, which was released in 1931. However, this is the one that really kicked off its popularity.
Yeah, I think you also have the previous year had Three-Cornered Moon, which also had Claude Colbert, and Bombshell, which also were kind of in that same, also in contention for first screwball comedy from the previous year.
And then I have one other influence, but I'll have to save it for spoilers.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's obvious this was a template for romantic comedies. We already mentioned DDLJ. But outside of romantic comedies, I was also thinking of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, which is kind of a romantic comedy, but platonic.
Yes, bromance comedy.
Yeah.
It's a bro rom-com.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Rom-com?
Rom-com. Yeah, there you go.
Yes, there we go.
But yeah, yes. You're right. I didn't think of that. But yeah, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Yeah, definitely with this.
Yeah, I thought about that right away. And then you mentioned parodies. There's been other things that have parodied it. Spaceballs apparently parodies a scene in here. But there's also some influences in culture as well, or at least rumored influences. There is a rumor that sales of men's undershirts declined after this because there's a scene where Clark Gable undresses and he's not wearing an undershirt, just his bare chest. So there's that rumor. Can't confirm or deny if it's true or not, but
there's that urban legend, which there was some crazy number though that says 75% of undershirt sales went down. And I'm thinking maybe because this was like the Great Depression and people were like, we can't afford undershirts, let's at least afford the top shirt.
Yeah, I think that might have had an influence as well.
They did find a newspaper article that said like sales drop after Clark Gable's reveal, but that news story, you know, it didn't give any statistics with it, any kind of factual data, and also mm-hmm. it was newspapers from like the 1930s,
which also makes me suspicious because I'm kind of, there's enough other news headlines that got ran back at the time that turned out to have more or less been drummed up as publicity that I'm not surprised. I think the Marx Brothers apparently famously did this with A Night in Casablanca, which came out after Casablanca. And I think there is something that they put out, I think with Groucher being like, they're trying to sue us for using Casablanca. Well, we don't care because we've been brothers longer than Warner Brothers have been brothers. And it was this whole thing. And it's just like, none of this is true, but it made for good headlines.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so anything that doesn't have numbers from that era makes me wonder if that was also some element of publicity machine.
Yeah, because they also said that because of this film, bus tickets surged, of sales of bus tickets, that went off. So, but like I said, no real hard evidence and no numbers, so I can't confirm or deny if that's true.
People taking the bus when they work like right across the street. I just want the experience. I wake up 30 minutes early just so I can take the bus. And also, James Bond said that this was the, you know, newspapers during 1930s, and how can they be trusted without factual data? Never mind. That's just newspaper. That's just news in general, because we still have that issue. Like, how many times has a politician just said something crazy like, crime rate has gone down 60% since this person has done this? Like, there's no data behind that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, as far as this being an influential film, we can see this, but it's also a significant film. Brian, do you want to start us off in talking about some of the significances of this film?
Yes, and I got quite a bit, so if you want to cut me off at any point, go ahead. This is the first film to complete...
All right, that's enough.
All right, go ahead.
No, sorry.
We mentioned that the Oscars were significant, and that's because this is the first film to complete a clean sweep, and only two films have done it afterwards. A clean sweep is when you win Best Picture, Best Director, Best Writing, Best Actor, and Actress. So that's what they call a clean sweep.
I say, and it's fairly unique for being really what is a light comedy to do that.
Yes, it's
that's
the only
a
comedy
genre that doesn't get attention.
Yeah, the other two to do it were One Flew Over a Cuckoo's Nest and Silence of the Lambs to win that 5 for 5.
I should clarify. I just mean like of Best Pictures, they're usually not.
Oh yeah, that so too. Yeah.
Best Director too. I'm pretty sure that's even rarer. Like a director of a comedy, you really don't see that.
Yeah, you don't.
Like you mentioned, this was released right when the Hays Code was released. Like, same
year. 4 months
before, Yeah, so it's interesting to see, like, even when you watch this movie, like, just because I've seen movies before and I know the Hays Code, I was like, I'm surprised this got passed. And I looked it up and I was like, oh. But I can see people during the Hays Code kind of doing the same tricks that they do to avoid, you know, being controversial or snuff. Now, one thing kind of significant about the period of the film, the time that this film was released, is that it was during the Great Depression. And it's significant for this film because you have one of your lead characters being extremely wealthy. Like, she's an heiress. And one of the things that they were worried about when they released this film is like, man, we're going to have a lot of people in the theater that are going to probably be hungry. Like, really, like, hungry, can't afford the next meal, don't know, like, how they're going to make it in life. And how are they going to, you know, watch this woman complain about her issues when she's all the when she's completely wealthy? But that didn't become too much of an issue. And I do think that they work pretty well of acknowledging the Great Depression during this time without actually saying it. You know, we see bums on trains. We see, you know, the singing on the bus for some change. And then it also, when you think about how this was during the time of the Great Depression, it gives certain gestures in this movie relating to money more of more weight. And we'll talk about those later. Mike, you mentioned how Clark Gable was on loan for this movie. This was back during the star system when they were stars were contracted to certain studios and they could not work with other studios, but studios would loan them out to other studios and they will receive money back from it. However, they did this to Clark Gable not to really receive money back, but more as a punishment. And I found a couple things stating why he was being punished. I don't know which one is true. One said that this was due to him having an affair. Now the studio, like, stars really represented their studios more than they do now. I mean, we still see it today, but an affair wouldn't really break you. But yeah, there was the affair. Somebody said that he requested a higher salary. And there was another one with him turning down a movie. And, you know, it could be in a culmination of all three. Who knows? So they say, you know what? You go work for Columbia. Mm-hmm. And everybody around started gasping. Like, oh, Columbia. That's because Columbia, man, Columbia was a poverty row. Like, this was, like, you either went Columbia and further down, two doors down, there were snuff films. So, like, it was bottom of the barrel. And so he was really upset that he was going to have to work for Columbia. Though he, after the first day, once he sobered up, he was actually, like, he was into it. And this was his first comedy, and it turned out that he was really good at it. Claudette Colbert kind of, she hated filming this all the way through, unfortunately. And she did not want to work for Columbia, didn't like the idea of it. They did ask, like, just the showing of her leg. It sounds like they were also going to do a nude scene at first, or at least a topless scene with her getting undressed. And she said no to that, which, yeah, watching the movie, I'm like, why would you even, like, that'd be so unnecessary.
I think it may not even been that, but just less dressed than she was. Mm. I think the point is just she had done very explicit or much more explicit scenes than what they were likely asking her for. But she was not thrilled with that for this.
Gotcha.
Yeah, she took a milk bath for the movie Cleopatra, but she did that for Paramount, right? Yeah, Paramount asked you to do that. You know, you hop right in.
That Cleopatra is I think a really solid film.
I haven't seen that one. I've seen the Elizabeth Taylor one, of course.
Personally, I think that one's the much better one.
Really? I'll check that out then.
Wait, the Elizabeth Taylor one or the other one?
I think Claudette Colbert
is better.
Cleopatra is a much stronger than Elizabeth Taylor.
Interesting.
Although I'm also not thrilled with Elizabeth Taylor usually.
Oh. Hmm. We'll get back to that. We got a lot.
Yeah.
Get back to that. Another thing, though, this set was kind of, it sounded like a fun set for the most part. Something that really wasn't used too often, but really worked for screwball comedies was improvisation. There, such as the Wall of Jericho, that was improvised. There were some other improvised lines in here that the director was allowing, which is interesting when you find out, like back in Hollywood, that wasn't allowed. You had your script and you went by it.
But I think that that definitely lends itself to the chemistry between them, I think, because they can be more natural.
Yes, definitely. We mentioned the tracking shot. And last thing I have is that this is one of Hitler and Stalin's favorite movies.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I did not see that one when I was doing my research.
No, I looked it up. I got two sources. Actually, I got multiple sources for it. And I'm not only surprised that they share this common film. One, I like to think that, you know, this is like where they kind of first had their meeting, or like they went to see this movie after they're meeting each other, kind of like a business thing, a business event. But I was surprised to see that I have three things now in common with Hitler, because I also really enjoyed this movie.
That's alarming.
Yeah, well, I also suck at art and I don't do well in the cold. So that's what it is.
I was saying, do we want to know your other two?
You don't want to know the fourth. So, yeah, that's what I got. That's what I found.
Mike, is there anything that you wanted to add?
I think I'd probably just say that there, some of what came up earlier kind of covers this, but this was also something that is treated as like one of the top romantic comedies of all time. Like, the AFI had it as number three when they did their 10 greatest romantic comedies of all time about 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been on a lot of AFI's different top 100 lists, both as a romance, both as a comedy, and just as a movie in general. Yeah. And this film also did just return to theaters in February for that 90th anniversary. It had a 4K restoration, which is pretty cool. And it was on, it was like released just in time for Valentine's Day too, which is, I think, a good move. So let's talk about who we would recommend this film to.
I would recommend this film to a lot of people. General mm-hmm. audience, all the way to cinephiles. I think general audience would, as long as they don't have an issue with watching black and white movies, they'll be surprised by, you know, how many laughs they'll find from this. And they, too, will be interested in, both them and cinephiles would be interested in just seeing common tropes coming from this movie. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll both be like, oh, wait, I've seen that in this. And I think that would be interesting for both.
Yeah, for me, it's the same, because I think that even if you don't like a lot of older movies, this is one I would probably recommend if you enjoy rom-coms, because I think that there's a lot of things in this film that modern audiences would cling on to very well. Mike, who would you recommend this to?
I think I would go general audience. I think, especially compared to a lot of older films, I think screwball comedies in general, I think our films in a modern audience would connect with better, because mm-hmm. there's a lot more quick-paced dialogue. And I think we've kind of gotten used to that with a lot of films, putting that in, that I think having something like this that really was some of the early films doing that. I think there's an, and there's enough sort of cultural touchstones in there mm-hmm. to be familiar enough that it's not quite as jarring as something that really feels like it's a very dated story. The idea of the press is going nuts because someone famous is missing after a marriage that has captured all the headlines does not require some level of disbelief or
yeah.
sort of some level of historic understanding the mm-hmm. way some other films have a lot more that you kind of have to know about the era.
Yeah, I agree. I do think that screwball comedies in general are very accessible films.
Yeah, I was just about to say, imagine Kate Middleton running away. That's all we would ever hear about.
I mean... So then let's go ahead and get into our classified section of the podcast. We're going to be talking spoilers now. We're going to be talking a little bit more spoilers of the story and our opinion as far as that goes. I know, Mike, you had some other significances that have to do with the ending of this film that we'll talk about. And we'll also be talking about if we think this film holds up and our overall rating of this film as well. So if you haven't seen this film and you don't want to be spoiled, go turn this off, go watch the film, and then come back to us. So Mike, let's start with you then. Let's talk about that significance you were mentioning.
I think you have somewhat mentioned it without knowing how thorough an overlap it is, which is I had seen Spaceballs many, many times by the time I saw this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And Spaceballs borrows like the last 20 minutes of got boy returns girl, boy goes to get money from girl's father, denies that he wants the or refuses the reward, takes just the amount that it cost him, then leaves, then she realizes, wait, he actually loved me, calls off the wedding in the middle of the wedding to chase after him. And so at some point, relatively early in that part of this film, I went, wait a minute, this is the ending of Spaceballs. This whole thing
okay.
is the ending of Spaceballs.
Gotcha.
And so it was somewhat surreal because it's such a large part of that movie that to realize where it's like, this is really just going to be all of this that it made the first time watching this movie distracting, because I'm like, this, how much of this is just going to be the exact bit of Spaceballs? And there's tweaks to it, but the beats, I mean, to the point where it is a walking down the aisle and the father is like, he didn't take the reward, wait a minute, and just like runs out of the wedding. Like, that whole bit was reused for Spaceballs. And it's enough that I think if you know Spaceballs, that very quickly goes, wait, I know how this movie ends. And I was not, it's different from just, oh, I know how these kind of stories go, to go, wait, no, this is the exact story I've already heard.
So the first time you watched this, did it kind of take you out of it?
A bit, yeah, because it was this weird realization. Just like, how much of is this? And then it was only looking at afterwards, going, okay, no, yeah, this is entirely a Spaceballs is referencing this. That it didn't take me out of it fully, but it definitely, it was a distraction that I was not prepared for.
Gotcha.
It's kind of, and there's one or two other comedies that do a similar thing with something near the end that is another movie, where when I've then seen the original movie and it throws me at first, just because I'm not, or things that I didn't realize were coming from a specific source. I have the same thing when I find songs that I only know the Weird Al version, and then I hear the original song, and it's very distracting until I get used to the song, because I'm like, I know this in a different version.
I had an experience like that recently with, I think it was Hitchcock's Notorious, I think it was, but I was like, oh, which is Mission Impossible 2.
Yeah, no. Or Wayne's World and The Graduate was one of the other ones for me.
Yeah, I've seen, so that was the influence I was going to mention, was this is the first movie where the bride or the groom leaves the altar. And yeah, it did remind me of The Graduate a bit. I have seen Spaceballs. I don't know if those were the two movies that you think you thought that one of us have seen and the other have seen it before.
Spaceballs was the one where I believe on the Blazing Saddles episode, you mentioned that you'd at least seen Spaceballs.
Yes.
And I was curious.
Yeah, I don't remember that ending. Honestly, it's probably because that movie felt so, I guess I want to say, stitched together. Like, it's a coherent film, but it doesn't really flow. So I honestly pieces of it I'm missing.
Yeah, and that's probably why that one feels weirder, because the rest of it is basically, how close can we get to being Star Wars?
Yeah.
Without George Lucas getting mad. That to then throw in a 1934 film for the last 20 minutes was just like, I was not prepared for that. I was prepared for more sci-fi and 70s, 80s kind of stuff. I was not prepared for that weird jump.
Yeah, it's a weird reference to have in that film.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. But this ending, I feel like I have seen it in another movie, like just the same with turn down the money. You know, the bride doesn't know about it, and I can't remember what it was.
Yeah, it's,
I have seen,
I know,
Wayne's
but
World.
It's been used before, but I can't think of what it is. And I think there's so many things in this film, but I'm like, I know I've seen this before, but if you ask me for an example, I can't give it to you.
Yeah, I will say this movie is archetypal enough that actually, I'd mentioned Love on the Run, which is basically this movie. The first, I had watched that years ago and had neglected to check if I'd watched it the second time I watched it. And so I was most of the way through that movie before I realized I'd already watched it several years ago, because I spent so much of it going like, do I remember this movie, or is this movie just, it happened one night so heavily that I'm just remembering it happened one night? For so much of those same beats.
One thing that reminds me of as well are the teen movies or the teen sitcoms where they make a bet to, the movie 10 Things I Hate About You makes a bet to go out with the nerdy girl or something, or take the girl out, and they find out it's a bet, and you find out that they never cared about the bet anyway anymore. And they actually did fall in love with them. That's a similar plot as well. So, I mean, you got two major plots in here, because he not only turns out the money, but turns down the story as well.
I mean, and there's a whole bunch of screwball comedies that even do the final scene is the wedding that you thought was going to happen is not the wedding that happens. I'm not sure if the spoiler section covers spoilers for movies that aren't this one, or if I should, because I can name a couple or I can not.
If they're not classics, I will say that you can. I don't know.
I think Double Wedding with William Powell does one of these, where it swaps weddings to people who had been hating each other towards the end and have developed a relationship. And I think also, I think it's The Awful Truth. Is another one.
Was that in The Awful Truth? I can't remember. I just watched that recently, too, and I can't remember it. What happened at the end?
There's a whole lot of wedding is off, new wedding, as the end of movies. Certainly in this one, though, I think this one does it. And this is part of why earlier I said I can't imagine this movie without The Wall of Jericho, even though that was sort of a thrown-in thing, is the way that this ends with the Wall of Jericho falling is just such a strong way to end a film that kind of just wraps everything up in such a good way, and also in a way that, and I wonder if this may reflect Capra's kind of taste more than anything else, that it wasn't a code thing, but that he preferred to keep it not explicit, because I don't think of his stuff as really pushing against the code. But that idea of they just call it the fall of the Wall of Jericho, but it's very clear to the audience what that really means is happening.
Mm-hmm. It's very suggestive.
Oh, yeah. that this ends with a trumpet, a toy trumpet, is just this weirdly perfect kind of ending where it is odd to think that that only happened. I don't know how this movie ends without that in a way that doesn't feel sort of anticlimactic.
Yeah.
You don't have that Wall of Jericho there to set that up.
I liked that ending. I did have a little bit of an issue with the ending in general. I think that for me, some of the pacing was a little bit rough after kind of like the falling out between the two characters. I think that it did drag a little bit in the pacing. But then also I wanted some kind of reconciliation scene between these characters. And I watched another movie, another rom-com like that recently with Jack Quaid, but I had the same kind of criticism with that, you know, it's very normal for rom-coms to have a falling out and then a reconciliation. That's just how these movies go. But when you don't have that scene where they're actually kind of opening up with each other after the fact, I do feel a little bit like I'm missing out on something. Because we definitely go from her leaving the wedding, he's not at the wedding, so you don't really get that interaction there, and then to the Wall of Jericho falling down, but you don't even get to see them as characters at that point. So it's kind of like implied that they got back together, also with a conversation of her father, but we just don't get to see that.
Ah, that is true. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It does bother me a little bit. Wow, Caitlin, wait. I didn't even notice that. Now it bothers me.
I think I kind of like it in the sense that I think it feels like the kind of situation where that would be a scene that, you know, the basic bits is them just both realizing or being in the same place to realize how one another feels. And I kind of feel like it's the sort of scene where by doing it the way they do it, you don't have that scene and screw it up. That feels like a very easy scene to get the tone wrong.
That's true.
And it kind of is that deal. It's the same kind of deal where a movie will deliberately not show something under the logic that what you imagine is going to work better than what they can necessarily do. This almost feels like it, that you can kind of interpret that how you would, to what extent that goes.
Yeah.
I'm now more interested what your opinion is going to be of another movie that we have in the future. It's going to be with the in terms of the ending, how they end it.
Is it a scheduled movie, like, do I know, or just like a general movie that we on our list?
I won't say.
Dang it, I want to know.
I'll try to remember. But also, Coming to America, I think, is the movie that's been on my mind. But I don't think I know someone turns down money, but I think there was another closer one. But Coming to America has a very similar plot.
Yeah, that's true.
And we talked about that one on the show, so if you went through skipping episodes, that's on you. That episode's been there. We won't exactly say what happens at the end of Coming to America, though. But with this movie, you know, talking about leaving the altar, one thing I want to talk about real quick, or not talk about, but mention that had me cracking up, was how quickly she booked it. As soon as she saw the opportunity, she was just gone, like just disappeared.
Yeah.
Like she did some kind of ducking move. I lost sight of her. Other people lost sight of her. And she just.
I really liked the shot of the cameras that are there to film the wedding.
Oh, yeah.
All on the top of a van, panning as she takes off running.
They're like, oh, yeah, this is a shot. Man, about time things got interesting. I thought I was going to have to use the explosives, but no, this is great. yeah, that was just a couple moments in here that had me cracking up. And again, they just feel kind of modern. The other one was the other scene that I really liked too that had me laughing was the undressing scene. I forget if that one was improvised or not, but just him, like, I don't know. It's just more of his smugness, but using it so well.
I say, I think that's my favorite scene, but I don't want to sound like a creep.
Yeah. Oh.
No, but they're very like back and forth of each other in that scene, and also the chemistry. Like, it's great. I think that this film for me is best when they're kind of trapped in that hotel room together.
Yeah, it's fun to watch that he's basically trying to see how long until she caves and like goes to her side of the room and just accepts the situation.
Yeah.
And so it's this sort of game of chicken that he's playing, which I think he makes the point, like, I do a weird thing and I take my shoes off next. And really, it's just he's drawing this out because he's not trying to be lewd. He's just like, how far do I have to go before she gives in on this?
Wait, were men taking off pants while their shoes were still on, though? Like, was there that much space in pants back then, or were feet that small?
I think that's where he's making a point about this, because he's really just drawing this out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, honestly, I think it's weird the shoes were still on at that point after the, because that's like shirt and stuff went first.
Are you thinking about the order in which you undress, Brian?
I am. Because one thing is, it's a hotel room. So, like, immediately you're in your room. Like, if I was walking in my house, I'd take off my shoes first, of course. But, like, if I was stepping into my hotel room. Now, like, if I'm in the office and I'm getting changed to, because also, like, the way I undress is different for dress clothes and casual wear. You know, business casual and casual wear. So, if I'm in the office getting changed for, you know, to go to the gym, or at least when I worked in the office, yeah, my shoes will kind of stay on till the last, you know, till I have to take my pants off. But I don't know. You know, audience, tell us. How do you do it?
I say, thanks, Brian, for this insight.
Yeah.
I can understand keeping the socks on for a while, but I feel like the shoes would still go early.
Yeah.
Especially because I think in that case, like, they've come out of the rain.
Yeah, like, unless I got some slippers or something.
Huh. This has been eye-opening.
Eye-opening moment. For those at home that are really, we're wondering about how Brian undresses.
Yeah, well, it just situation dictates, really. You know, I'm an adaptive character.
Mm-hmm. I think my other favorite moment that kind of, you know, it's kind of, he's like seeing like how far he can push her, was just like the next morning when he's threatening to drag her out of bed and she just kind of scrambles. And I think that's when I really fell in love with her character, because she's scrambling. She's like, oh, I'm up. And it was just like such a sweet moment from her. Like, she was just so cute. It was adorable. And I don't know. I like that there are dynamics in that like morning scene, because it's the first time you really, really see them really interacting kind of nicely to each other. They have a breakfast together. They kind of play pretend that they're married to get out of questioning. And so, yeah, I really like
that,
those scenes.
I think that one, I think, is actually the one that I think is probably my favorite of their dynamic, because for so much of this, you really see them as adversarial. And that's the first time where you really see what they can both do working together. And what I particularly like is there's some comments, like things that they had said earlier. Like, she makes a comment about Rather being a plumber's daughter or something. Like, she made some brief reference there. And so then they end up in the situation where people are showing up because there's reports that it's her and they're trying to find her. And so he starts a argument so that it seems like they're married and just in the middle of a fight when they show up. And he uses that same comment about her being a plumber's daughter. Mm-hmm. So it's pulled from like their earlier conversation, but the point at which she figures out what's going on and starts to play into it, because I think it's like it's mostly just him yelling at her. And it's not until he makes some comment about, like, just like when that Swede made a pass at you and she comes back, like, he didn't say anything and says he was drunk. And that's the point where it's like they are now working together for kind of the first time. And sort of like the laughter that they have after that is like, that's the first time that to me where it's really worked as how they can work together and not just that they're stuck with one another and kind of putting up with it. Like, it almost feels like they are having fun with this, even though they're doing this by necessity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, agreed.
How did you feel about, like, her confession scene? Like, when she finally confessed her feelings for him?
Oh.
Because she's really the one that takes the initiative there.
Yeah, I like that scene, and I liked, again, Mike, you said that this movie, you know, it does well of why there's these misunderstandings and miscommunication. It's not like they just need to have an adult conversation now. It's like they kind of keep, you know, they're out of step, you know, when he goes back and she's asleep. So I did like her confession scene. I thought it was nice, you know. I thought it was going to be one of those where they don't say anything, you know, mm-hmm. or she just kind of whispers it without him hearing. And she's like, I love you. And he's like, what? Olive juice. We need to get olive juice. So I thought it was cute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it makes it very understandable that, like, he kind of takes that information in and is like, okay, I have to do something because, like, I cannot ask an heiress to marry me when I have nothing because she's given away the last couple dollars I had.
Yeah. Was it $39?
$39.60. Mm-hmm. And it's actually, I mean, one, you can see why he tries to get that money back. If you look at times of Great Depression, how much $39 would be worth, I can see it. And but it's it makes that part where he puts down $1,000. When he gives $1,000 back after already leaving with it, and when he turns $10,000, not only do you have to think about inflation, but the fact that they were in Great Depression. Like, that's, that man, like, really turned down, you know, that takes you to a new livelihood during that time and gives you a lot of structure. Like, you now have, like, a basis to stand on. Like, you know you're going to be good for the next, you know, year or two.
Was the movie openly set in the Great Depression, though?
Yeah, from what I was reading, it was. Mm-hmm. But they didn't say it, but there were things.
It was a contemporary setting at the time, so this didn't necessarily need to be said so much as everyone knew that's what they were still dealing with.
Mm. And they had things in there that, like, were related to the Great Depression. Like I said before, with the train, I was about to say the trains on the bums. The bums on the trains and the people singing on the bus, and the mother who fainted during the bus ride, mm-hmm. had fainted due to hunger, not just because women easily fainted during those times.
Yeah. I know that, like, some screwball comedies are more seen as, like, escapism, so I don't know if, like, this was actually, like, explicitly set in the Great Depression.
I think a lot of them almost do use it as a commentary on class. Okay. That a lot of them, it is a key component to those, is that you can look at it and there is, I think Holiday comes to mind as one that is someone from a poor background marrying into a rich family and dealing with how messed up the rich family is, kind of stuff. There's, okay. I think there's a whole genre of, like, screwball comedies that basically are, or comedies in general of that era, which are basically, poor person is dealing with rich people and is the only one that has any clue how things should really work, because the rich people are dumpster fires. I think Good Girls Go to Paris is a very obscure 1939 film that I think is amazing that does exactly that. Like, it's, I've been watching as a weird side project to slightly torment myself. I've basically been trying to watch every movie I can from 1939.
Gotcha.
And so I'm going very obscure. And the amount of times that really are in fairly light comedies, but also a key component of this is, and also, what the heck's wrong with wealthy people, does start to show up. And actually, even just a couple years after this, Frank Capra would do You Can't Take It With You, which also is very much it's comedy, but there's still clearly criticism, or somewhere between criticism or satire of effectively the wealthy class.
Yeah.
And what they're not understanding. Sullivan's Travels, maybe the one that does this most explicitly as a screwball comedy, which very crudely is a director wants to make a movie, actually called Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which is what that movie is referencing in its title. Hmm. And he wants to make a movie about what it's like to be poor and suffering, because it's the Depression, everyone's poor and suffering. And he's basically told, you have no idea what it's like to be poor. It's like, fine, I'll go prove it. And one of the key themes really is, it's an element of the value of escapism. You don't have to make everything be dark to reflect a dark reality. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's a comedy that is still making points about wealth and satirizing that. So I think there's a lot that don't bother with the escapism. It's just very clear that they're siding. There's not so much that succeeded that did have the poor considered using their bootstraps.
Yeah. Is there anything else you guys want to talk about while we have spoilers up?
No.
I think, like I said, the Spaceballs one is my biggest okay. one, because that is so defining to me.
So then let's talk about if we think that this film holds up. And I think we kind of already did touch upon this, but let's just go over it again.
I think so. With it, again, not really being so explicit the time period that it is in, it almost feels sort of timeless. The humor holds up. I mean, this, you know, we've seen this plot again and again. So yeah, I think this is a film that really well, very well does hold up.
I think I would agree with that. There's a couple specific lines that I definitely think someone who is watching it now and thinking of it as a modern movie would find a bit jarring. Specific lines or actions that come across as that do feel a bit more dated in terms of mostly Clark Gable's comments on how to handle a woman.
Yeah, like some of that misogynistic kind of side that we're talking about.
And there's kind of a thing where I'm like, for 1930s, I don't think it's doing anything remotely out of the ordinary. And if anything, it's probably mostly treating her as a stronger character than a lot of movies mm-hmm. would for the 1930s. And so it's one of those ones with, in historical context, it's not, I don't say it's not a thing, but it's not
as jarring.
It's not a central thing. So it's fairly easy to remove that and still have the core story there and not get distracted by it. Whereas there are other things that, like the key points are a problem. Mm-hmm. Here it's kind of a couple lines that don't work well.
Yeah. I don't think it's a lot.
Yeah. I don't think it impedes the rest of the movie from working.
Mm-hmm. And like my takeaway from that is that I didn't really feel like that reflected his true feelings anyways,
yeah.
personally.
And also I think something that helps is that some of it is in good intentions, like him mm-hmm. kind of being in charge of her finances.
Like, yeah. I think they're good. That was good the intentions. One thing yeah. I was like, oh.
Yeah. But I was like, I mean, she was about to spend $1.60 on some candy. She only has $4. That's just, I mean, I want to take control of her finances, but I make some, you know, some criticism nowadays. Yeah,
that was the one where, and I think where he more took that attitude, I think also because it worked to get the person to go, and then he could explain it to her later without explaining it to her and the guy trying to make a living. And so he's curt in a way to kind of be like, I will explain why this is a problem after this, but for now, we're going to prevent this from happening. And he kind of does a similar thing to keep her from taking advantage of people at a couple spots, where it's a situation where he's abrupt with her, but I think it's to prevent other people also getting hurt by the fact that she has, like, no money and has not adjusted to that.
Mm.
And she makes her own financial decision later on, kind of with his money,
yeah.
and gives it to a little boy. So it's like, you know, I think that's some development there. Like, she's learning, like, you know, like, once she understands the weight of money, and she, you know, is making that decision, even knowing that. Also, there's times, I mean, he picks her up and walks her across a river. He makes a bed for her. So there are like some things, there are a lot of things that he's doing, you know, for her. It's just, there's some old fashioned chivalry, I guess, or masculinity being there.
Halfway across the river, he spanks her.
She was spanking him first, though, but with shoes.
I think there's different tones to those spanks.
I mean, my thing was that, like, his actions speak louder than his words, right, in this film. So he's doing a lot of things for her, and, like, he's complaining about it the whole way, but you can clearly see, like, it's a front.
Yeah, definitely the stuff he says at the end.
Yeah, about, like, one soccer to put in her place. Yeah, but I was like, okay. Someone's hurt.
That's the one where everything else he's saying is him trying to, and he's called out for it, mm-hmm. he's trying to put up a front
yeah.
very strongly, and it is not working. And so that's certainly the part where, like, that one I'm like, I can see someone hearing that and kind of having a knee-jerk response and ignoring that everything he has just said has been either an attempt to avoid answering a question, yeah. directly not true, or really him basically deriding himself to try to get out of the question.
Yeah.
You know, someone would have to be crazy. It's like, that's not an answer.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that scene. And so, do you love her? Someone had to be crazy. Like, do you love her, though?
Yes, but don't hold it against me. Yeah. What do you say? I'm a bit crazy in the head, too, or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a great line.
So, yeah. So, like, that comment in there, I can see someone missing the context and be like, you shouldn't be thinking he's talking sincerely at this point.
Yeah.
But it is it's jarring enough now that I can see someone noticing that and then not contextualizing it of, don't take this seriously.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to. No one was ever supposed to think that's his sincere statement.
But yeah, I do think that overall this film holds up. Like I said, there's a lot of tropes. Even like the behavior that he has, it kind of has that, like I said, that enemies to lovers type trope that people are eating up right now. So like it's, I think that, like I said, I think that modern audiences would really connect to this even still. And I think that's why it's a testament to the film.
You can find that trope every decade. I mean, that's everything from African Queen to Empire Strikes Back to Romancing the Stone to modern film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the way that this, because it feels so familiar, but it's also fresh. Like I said, it's tropey, but I think that just the dynamics, they feel fresh. So yeah, I think it definitely holds up.
I think the only other thing that feels weirdly dated, but I enjoy it for its quaintness, is the reference to the autogyro at the end instead of a helicopter.
Oh yeah, I didn't know what that was. I was like,
what? Yeah, it's a term that I only know because I think part of the Simpsons attempt to always make Mr. Burns seem dramatically old is for him to use terms that are ridiculously out of date. Which it's things like he answers the phone with ahoy hoy, because that was like, I think, like one of the suggestions for like how people should answer the phone when phones were invented.
Oh.
And so like he's using a term that no one else has used outside the first like 2 years of phones.
Gotcha.
And so there is bits on The Simpsons where he will talk about an autogyro, and it's because in 1930s, that was the term because they hadn't really settled down on a helicopter yet.
Gotcha. I did not know that.
Which is surprising seeing how you have a helipad, Caitlin.
Yeah, the helipad on my apartment building roof. Yeah, I've talked to my landlord and we're like, yeah, sure, you can have that.
Yeah, I think autogyropad just doesn't roll off the
top.
Yeah,
not quite. So let's go on and move on to our overall rating of this film. Brian, do you explain how our rating system works?
Yeah, so our rating system, it is a letter grade system. And however, we do have an S rating for any film that you feel is just, you know, it's just above and beyond. Maybe there's some personal sentiment there, but it's just top tier movie making at that point. And then you can go all the way down to an E, or if you just completely hate it, which I don't think we've had yet, but you can put in an F rating.
Oh, no. Then I would have given Texas Chainsaw an F.
Would you? You didn't
E
give
is our
E?
Lowest. Yeah, I did.
Oh, yeah.
It's
okay.
Our, my bad. E is our lowest.
E is our lowest.
Yeah.
Sorry, I thought we haven't got to that.
No.
I thought we haven't got to E yet.
Yeah. For personal feelings.
So, Mike, what will you give it?
This is tough. I think I looked at the overall rating with a standard, like, academic grading. But now that you throw in the S tier, I'm very close between A or S. I think before rewatching it, I would have fairly solidly been at it's an A, and this is one that has grown on me each time I have rewatched it, I think.
You can also do pluses or minuses, so you could do an A plus.
I think I'm gonna go A plus. I think I'm not entirely on S tier, but this is, that feels a bit more exclusive, but I also know, like, I think this has gone up to a 5-star film on Letterboxd for me. Like, this is raised itself up an extra half star. So I'll go A plus. That feels about right.
Okay. Bryant?
I'm going to go with A minus. I think maybe some things could have been stronger at the ending. Not just what you said, Caitlin, but I don't know. I think it didn't really get muddled, but it didn't feel as tight as the rest of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So, but man, there's so much to enjoy from this. So many lines this is an A movie, A minus.
Yeah, I'm right there with you in A minus for the same reasons with the ending and what I mentioned before. But I really did like this movie. I really enjoyed it. And like I said, I just enjoy screwball comedies.
I do too. Now I know that about myself. I do.
Mm-hmm. Is this my favorite Capra film now? Probably not. But also, the thing with me is Arsenic and Old Lace has a like sentimental value for me, so I think that'll always be my favorite. But this is I like this definitely better than It's a Wonderful Life and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, though.
Oh, I didn't know he did It's a Wonderful Life.
We literally just had that episode.
I don't remember that. I mean, I guess those are the only two I've seen. So I'll put this above it.
I think I would put this possibly below both Our Second Old Lisa and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Okay. But above It's a Wonderful Life. Interesting.
I need to rewatch it. I am not that fond of It's a Wonderful Life.
Not either. It's all right.
It's fine.
I now find it rather amusing that there's even a Jimmy Stewart film that I think is better that is almost the same title of It's a Wonderful World.
Mm.
It's like that I can get behind. I need to give It's a Wonderful Life another rewatch, but like I have never gotten the level of the appeal that one has.
Yeah, I did like it better the second time I watched it, to be fair. But still not up there for me.
But yeah, no. This is making me realize that Capra has got a stronger set of films than I realized. Because I think also You Can't Take It With You is also Capra and was also way up there.
Gotcha.
So now I'm beginning to wonder what I've watched that wasn't good.
He's definitely a good comedy director. Definitely.
I was just going to give credit to I think a lot of this film has to do with writing as well. Robert Riskin. I don't think I've seen any of his other movies, though he did do the original Mr. Deeds, which I didn't learn until much later that Mr. Deeds, Adam Sandler's Mr. Deeds, was a remake.
I did not either. Interesting. Well, then that wraps up this episode. And Mike, I want to say thank you for joining us. And I think I was looking at your website and it said that season 2 of your podcast starts again in April, which I guess will be this month when this podcast airs.
Yeah. So we are currently doing some light episodes that are just kind of across the board, whatever we've been playing recently.
Okay.
So it's to have some stuff on there that doesn't involve quite as much work in the shorter episodes. And then we will be resuming when we start season 2 on April 24th, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It will be with Sonic the Hedgehog 2.
Okay. Yeah, we'll definitely put a link to that in our episode description. And also, I didn't know if you wanted to share anywhere else they can find you, maybe your Letterboxd.
Yeah, so for the podcast, The Old Switcheroo, that's Switch A-R-O-O. That's anywhere you can find podcasts and on YouTube. Websites, theoldswitcheroo.com. And then for all the movie stuff that I can't somehow tie into talking about video games, which is more than you'd think you could get away with, but not as much as I'd like to do, I am on Letterboxd as Lobacca, Lowbacca.
Okay. And so our next episode, we are switching things up. We're not doing romantic comedy again. We are going to do a horror movie with The Omen, the 1976 Omen. It's the first Omen, but it's not the first Omen, which is going to cause some headaches for me and Brian.
I think it already caused headaches for you and I the first time where I'm like, are we doing a bit or something? What is going on? I think we're good now. I just feel bad for everybody else who hasn't got it situated because it is. And it's worse than when Scream 5 came out and it was just Scream.
Yeah, that was bad.
I think this is Omen 4 or something. I don't know if this is the only Omen prequel. So I don't know if we have another name for it. But yeah, the first Omen, not the first Omen.
Yes.
Which will we do in the first Omen? Not just for the core episode, first Omen, but we'll be doing the first Omen for bonus objective.
Yeah.
I believe.
So two first Omens.
Yes.
In different ways.
God, I already
just hate
turned
this into
movie.
A real Abbott and Costello meet Damien kind of thing.
Yeah, pretty much what happened. I forget what episode we did that on. We were just talking. We were just doing our meeting scheduling and we got confused with each other. Like Caitlin was like, really like, so wait a minute. What is the Omen that's coming out? I was like, the first Omen. It's like, yeah, I know we're doing the first Omen, but what are we doing? Why are we doing this movie?
Okay, wait, so the new one is the first Omen?
The new one is called The First Omen, yeah.
Okay. I knew they had a new Omen, but I didn't know it was the first, yeah.
Yeah, very confusing. But the one we will be covering on our normal episode is the original Omen from 1976. And in the meantime, if you want to connect with us, you can find us on social media. Pretty much all social media now, we're at OpSilverScreen. That's Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube now as well. So you can find us there. Facebook, it's still Operation Silver Screen, but everywhere else, it's OpSilverScreen. And I think by the time that this airs too, we're going to have a little bit more on the YouTube. We had our interview that we posted on our podcast with George Stevens recently, but we did do a special video recording, so feel free to check that out on our YouTube as well. And if you want to find us on our personal letterboxes, if you want to see what else we're watching throughout the week, I'm at Coffee Spoon Kate, that's Coffee Spoon C-A-I-T, and Bryant, he's at Swank Seal, that's capital S, capital S.
Thanks again for joining us, Mike.
Thanks for having me. It's been an absolute blast.
Till next time, I'm Bryant.
And I'm Caitlin.
See you.